Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We look at the struggle for truth about Israel and Palestine.
Israel's 62 years old. It's time to, like, really look at the founding myths and say, okay, well, what's working and what's really not in our favor?
Our guest is Dr. Alice Rothschild, an obstetrician and gynecologist who has long been committed to women's rights and human rights. She was raised in a conservative synagogue and Hebrew school, yet her commitment to human rights led her right into the center of the crisis between Israelis and Palestinians. She found the lack of information about Palestinian history troubling and has expressed concern over Israel's refusal to allow medical personnel to cross into Gaza, that despite a mounting humanitarian crisis in the wake of Israeli air and ground assaults earlier this year. Dr. Alice Rothschild is author of Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. She is also co-chair of Jewish Voice for Peace, Boston. Dr. Rothschild, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You've been a strong voice demanding that medical personnel be allowed to enter Gaza. What does it mean to Palestinians that the blockade prevents doctors and others from getting to them and bringing in aid?
Well, I think if you go back to the Geneva Conventions, which are international conventions, it's pretty clear that healthcare personnel are supposed to be allowed to do their work unfettered in war zones and times of occupation in the kinds of settings that the West Bank and Gaza frequently experience. And one of the issues in this area of the world is that local healthcare providers, as well as internationals, have repeated difficulties providing healthcare, ambulance drivers getting where they need to get, all that kind of basic medical care that's necessary. In particular, what's going on in Gaza is that for the last few years, there's been a very tight blockade that gets tighter periodically depending on Israeli policy. And there are many, many internationals that are very concerned about what's happening to healthcare in Gaza, as well as the economy and the general status of the people. So there have been multiple episodes to enter Gaza to break the blockade in some way, to enter as internationals doing humanitarian work. The Israeli government doesn't favor that particular behavior. So last fall, when I was with a group of professionals that were trying to go to a conference on war and mental health in Gaza, none of us could get permits to enter. So that was just a symptom of that chronic problem.
And I know, too, that you focus on the struggle for human rights in both Israel and Palestine.
Right.
And so you're really looking at the consequences for both the occupier and the occupied.
Absolutely. I'm not someone who is pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. I feel that both of these peoples are destined to share this piece of land. And the question is, using values that we all believe in and that are basic human rights values, how can we move this conversation forward? And I also think that not only is the facts of occupation really destructive to the people who are being occupied, it also destroys the people who are doing the occupying. I mean, you can't be a 20-year-old soldier at a checkpoint and have a huge amount of power over a huge civilian population and carry a big gun and then go home at night and be a totally different person with your family. So there's an increase of domestic violence in Israel. There's an increase in young people trying to get out of the army. I mean, the symptoms are seen within Israeli society.
Do you think that one of the reasons medical personnel like you are denied access to Gaza and other parts of Palestine has to do with the Israelis not wanting human rights for Palestinians to be strengthened as an argument, which, of course, medical personnel have historically been very good at doing?
I think the whole issue comes down to framing. Official Israeli governmental policy frames the issues very differently than people who are looking at this from a human rights perspective. And I think that medical personnel, given our training, our ability to bear witness, our ability to listen in a way that we do in an office with a patient, we can also do this on a social scale, actually threatens the framing of people who don't want to look at this from a human rights perspective.
And that brings me to some of your writing. I noticed, I think it was a letter to the editor in Jewish Currents back in January, February of 2009. At any rate, you were talking about standing in the rubble of, I think it was Rafah, a demolished neighborhood in southern Gaza where Rachel Corrie, the U.S. human rights worker, had been killed. You know, you say that there was just so much destruction, But then you noted the children's toys and little bits of broken lives, lost shoes, underwear, a doll, a computer game. And this really hit you hard, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Both as a physician and as a writer and as someone who's an observer of human behavior, I am really interested in how to make the realities real to other people in a way that breaks through resistance. And so someone can say, well, you know, this was a security move, and the Israelis needed a buffer between Egypt and Rafah or whatever. But to bring home that families were in their houses living their lives and the bulldozers came in the middle of the night and people grabbed their children and ran out of fear, and to make that real to people is the real challenge for people like me. So that was one of my ways of looking at, like, can you imagine looking down and seeing all the detritus of a human life right before you and understanding how it got there? And, you know, when you compare that to, for instance, the care and the publicity and all the stuff that went with removing the 8,000 Jewish settlers from Gaza, you know, those people suffered tremendous loss, et cetera, but they were treated as human beings, whereas the people in Rafah were not. And that's very, very disturbing.
I'd like to just compare media coverage for a minute here. In Iran, post-election, we've seen a lot of, you know, demonstrations and then a heavy-handed reaction from the Iranian leadership, Ahmadinejad's power being threatened and challenged. And the United States has reacted in a variety of ways, members of the peace movement a little bit unsure of what's happening, but wanting to support people who are being attacked, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the response of the media, particularly National Public Radio, has been interesting to watch. In a discussion about this recently, an NPR reporter spoke about pride, you know, Iranian pride, and really Iranian-American pride at what this civilian population of Iran were putting themselves through in order to get their rights assured. Compare that to the coverage of the Jewish response, because I know you've written about some of the opposite kinds of feelings. You don't feel proud to be, you know, someone from a country who has made this kind of damage to the civilian population possible in support for the Israeli government.
Well, I think there's a general cultural taboo that is longstanding, particularly in the United States, about expressing sympathy for Palestinian aspirations, rights, historical, international rights as well. This is a complicated thing because Israel was founded in the ashes of the Holocaust in the face of tremendous world guilt. There's a lot of sympathy for Jews as victims. The Christian evangelical right wants all the Jews to go back to Israel so that there can be an apocalypse. I mean, there are a lot of different forces that lead the press and our country to be much more sympathetic to Jewish Israelis than to Arabs or Palestinians. And it's also part of our own racism. And so when you see what's going on in the media, how something is reported, if it's something is going on in the West Bank or Gaza, it's framed as terrorism rather than a struggle against oppression, because it's a taboo for Israel to be seen as the oppressor. And I think one of the most painful things for me as a Jewish person is to really come to terms with the fact that the policies of the Israeli government are deeply oppressive to Palestinians and that we bear responsibility for that, and that unless we face up to that, this is just going to go on and on and on. We could talk for hours about why does the media report what it reports, but even if you look at the language, I mean, frequently the occupied territories is referred to as disputed territories. Palestinians are referred to as Arabs as if they don't have a particular historical place that they came from. You know, the Irgun and the Stern Gang are liberation organizations rather than terrorist organizations. I mean, you know, the language is built into our cultural assumptions about who's right and who's wrong and who was the more deserving victim. And that's very problematic.
Just tell listeners what the Irgun was, Dr. Rothschild.
The Irgun and the Stern Gang were both basically Jewish terrorist organizations that existed before the founding of Israel and that were responsible for blowing up buses, killing civilians, doing the kind of things that we would associate with terrorist groups. And because the people who were in these organizations, Ben-Gurion, Begin, the people who became the founding fathers of Israel, won the struggle. They became the heroes. And what I always say is, you know, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. And so it's very interesting to look at how history is written by the victors and how history is written by the victims and how particular activities are framed. So that's what I was referring to.
Back in 2007, you were writing about the increasing number of Israeli flags that could be found draped over homes on a hill in a section of East Jerusalem called Silwan.
Right.
And that's the much sought after dream that Palestinians would be able to turn this part of Jerusalem into their capital. Archaeologists and religious Jews were seeking to claim this part of Jerusalem as the ancient city of David, which kind of brings to mind the right-wing support for the settlement construction that comes from America, you know, it really in collaboration between right-wing religionists like Ralph Reed and also Rabbi Yekiel Eckstein, who actually raises money to bring Jews from places like Russia and Ethiopia to Israel to become citizens there. The profound effect that this nationalistic evangelical view of a sacred land that belongs to Jews has been problematical, particularly as it's translated by politicians.
Well, it's very interesting to look at how religion has been used in this conflict. The early Zionists from the 1880s were not religious people, but they figured out very early that they could use the Bible as sort of a real estate document and the sense of religious entitlement. They could use it as a very powerful mover and to create the reasoning that makes it possible for Israel to exist where it exists. I mean, when they were originally looking for a homeland, they looked at all sorts of places. It wasn't only historical Palestine. The issue that I was writing about the neighborhood Silwan, which is in East Jerusalem, I wanted to use this because it's a particularly powerful example of the doublespeak that goes on. So, for instance, if you say to Israelis, do you want peace, do you want a two-state solution, blah, 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 they'll say yes. But then you say, okay, let's look at what's going on the ground. Here is an area of East Jerusalem that has been traditionally Palestinian for a long time, and here we have the State of Israel saying Jerusalem is East and West are now united since the 67 war, and they've laid claim to basically an occupied part of the city. And they're moving in the most right-wing settlers in a variety of ways that involve people like Irving Moskowitz, who's a very wealthy American doctor who funds a lot of the stuff, as well as evangelicals and other movements, which is going to make this part of the city an area that is becoming more settled by Jewish settlers. And then you have all the different peace agreements that have been progressing along and none of which have happened, which all look at a two-state solution with East Jerusalem as the capital. So you're sort of in a collision course here. But one of the policies of the Israeli government has been to create facts on the ground so that whenever the endgame starts happening, Jewish Israelis have gobbled up as much territory as possible. And so this is an example of how that is happening at breakneck speed. And no one talks about it, but this is a real problem because for Palestinians, 40% of the economy is from East Jerusalem. It's a major center of, you know, religion and historically and a lot of other things. And so losing East Jerusalem would be catastrophic if you're actually looking for a viable Palestinian state. And so this raises the whole question of, well, what are the policymakers really looking for? Is it a greater Israel with a sort of Bantustan apartheid kind of thing in the middle with the Palestinians in Swiss cheese neighborhoods, you know, without access to each other? Or are we really thinking of a viable state? If we're thinking of a viable state, then we wouldn't be moving Jews into what is the future capital. That's sort of an example of the kind of doublespeak that goes on.
And of course, a lot of peace activists in the U.S. were concerned when Barack Obama, the candidate, began embracing AIPAC and groups that were intent on, let's say, building Israel up, even in spite of some of the things we were seeing in Gaza. At the same time, Obama was embracing AIPAC. The Gazan people were being ravaged by bombing and an invading force that, you know, a lot of civilians were killed by. And so when you talk about the politics here, I think it's a little bit painful to think about the idea that someone like Irving Moskowitz, I looked him up after reading your piece, by the way, to find out more about him. He's a bingo magnet, but, you know, these are political figures who right. have long supported the Republican National Committee. So I right. think there's a real question as to why Obama has been, if you will, pressured so effectively mm-hmm. by these forces.
I think that Obama at one time did express some sympathy for Palestinian suffering and aspirations. And as soon as he became a serious national figure, that language went away. And then as soon as he became a more serious national figure, he began to kowtow to AIPAC and appear at their breakfast and declare Jerusalem united and do say the things that someone who wants to be elected in the United States has to say, which for people like me is extremely painful to watch. I would also argue that ultimately that's not good for Israel. People will frame my kind of comments as, quote, anti-Israel, but I really feel just like in our country we had to face the fact that we were born in slavery, that we dispossessed Native Americans, that we interned Japanese. I mean, we have our own history of racist, backward things that we have done and continue to do in various ways, that we are stronger for facing this, and we are more democratic and egalitarian and have more moral authority. And I think that Israelis are going to need to do that same kind of work. Kowtowing to AIPAC is not a positive thing for Israel. I mean, AIPAC is to the right of most Jewish Americans and often to the right of the Israeli government. So they're not actually a helpful player, but they're a very powerful, well-funded player and influential.
You've also written about Avigdor Lieberman and his impact on Israeli society, his tendency toward fevered and nationalistic assertions about the need to have Israel dominated by Jews. Now, that brings up questions of race, even though a lot of people have pointed out historically the importance of realizing that this is a land dispute, not a racial one necessarily. But about race, it seems Lieberman is trending in the direction of wanting Israel to be a Jewish state without other races. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a complicated assessment because Jews aren't a race. Now, over 50% of Jewish Israelis are Sephardic or Mizrahim, which means they're from Arabic-speaking countries or Northern Africa. So race is kind of the wrong word to use here. But you can say that Avigdor Lieberman favors Jews over everybody else, and his solution to the problems within Israel, and I think within the occupied territories, is to get rid of Palestinians. And that ultimately is a disastrous policy.
When I watch some of the fundraising infomercials that are put together by this Stand With Israel mm-hmm. group, and also, again, Rabbi Eckstein, because he has become very powerful in Israel today. But one of the things they do say frequently, in addition to pointing out that we're headed toward the end days, is that Jews from Russia and other countries need to return to Israel. That's an important word, because I'm not convinced that they were born in Israel. So to use the word return, what's the meaning there?
Well, this is one of those hot-button rally-around-the-flag kind of phrases. First of all, there's a huge debate over whether Ashkenazic Jews, Eastern European Jews, ever actually came from historic Palestine. So that's one huge debate. But for me, this is an interesting misuse of the Torah or biblical history, because there are a lot of people who lived in historic Palestine. There were Romans, there were Greeks, there were Canaanites, there were the Ottomans. There were a lot of different groups. And so the question is, why do the Jews get to come back and no one else gets to come back? Or why do the people who've lived there for centuries have less rights than the people who claim they are Jewish but have never actually been there? And so this is the manipulation of religion and public policy and culture to give Israel a moral authority. And I always say, well, if you're going to use the Torah, why stop at the Jordan River? Didn't Jews once get to Euphrates? I mean, this is an artificial kind of explanation. It's like the archaeological digs that are going on in East Jerusalem that are being run by these right-wing groups like Elad, these NGOs that have a right-wing agenda. They're smashing through all the archaeology that they don't want to know about till they get something Jewish. Well, that's crazy. This is a place that has been conquered over and over again, and there are a lot of people that have laid claim to it. So why do the Jews get preferential treatment? It's completely a manipulation for me. It's also problematic if you then say, okay, well, the Jews have preferential treatment over everybody else, because then you're really in a very a moral quagmire in terms of how you behave and your politics and how you work towards, if the goal is to have a peaceful future and to be able, I mean, what is the goal? The goal is for Jews to have a safe place to live. Well, the question is creating a Jewish state with a very antagonistic attitude towards everybody else the way to do it? And, you know, I would argue if you look at history, Jews have been safest in multicultural pluralistic societies and in Islamic societies, if you want to look at the facts. So this is very self-destructive as far as I'm concerned. Although I understand historically how it happened, I think Israel's 62 years old. It's time to, like, really look at the founding myths and say, okay, well, what's working and what's really not in our favor?
We've just seen Sarah Palin step down in Alaska from governor. And, you know, I wonder if we can compare some of the rhetoric surrounding figures like Palin to some of the rhetoric surrounding figures like Lieberman. You know, it's interesting that a lot of Americans don't realize that she is an evangelical Christian from what I would have to describe as a rather militant background, a controversial background, as are some of these figures we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And there is the question of, to what extent do people get affected by some of their own rhetoric? And I mean, it's possible people have given themselves so much permission to say, for example, we're going to plant sacred trees, Jews are going to engage in aliyah, sacred, holy, but we're going to at the same time knock down Palestinian trees.
Right.
And it becomes absurd, but I think there are people who question the extent to which any individual involved in all of the presentation of this, whether or not they actually believe some of what they're speaking about at a given time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, because I think the early pioneers like Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan knew that there were Palestinians there and were very clear on what they were doing. There's this famous quote from Herzl in 1885 with this Zionist conference in Basel in Switzerland, and he sent a group of rabbis to the Holy Land to see what was cooking. And they sent back a telegram that said, the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. So the idea that this region of the world was going to be ethnically cleansed of Palestinians to make room for the Jews was very clear to the people who started this. I don't know how clear it is now, because if you look at Israeli culture and Israeli education, I mean, the Palestinian dispossession is not taught in Israeli schools, Jewish schools. And in fact, there was recently a big hullabaloo about passing a law that made it illegal to celebrate the Nakba, which is the Palestinian dispossession. And finally, the compromise was that you could celebrate it, but there would be no state funding. Well, 20% of the population is Palestinian. So imagine a state where 20% of the people cannot easily publicly acknowledge the most critical moment in their history. I mean, what kind of state is that? So there's some people that know, and there's some people that never knew and don't, you know, are not politically aware and don't read the internet and don't read books, and, you know, they're like most of us. They're just plodding along trying to get to school and work and raise their kids, and they're oblivious. You know, it's like when you talk to people who live in Maale Adumim, which is a Jewish settlement near Jerusalem, 35,000 people, multiple neighborhoods, a college for pilots and astronauts, a big industrial area. They don't even consider themselves settlers. They think of themselves in outer Jerusalem. And the fact that this settlement is one of the most destructive settlements in terms of a two-state solution, because it cuts the West Bank in half for Palestinians and makes it very difficult for them to go from north to south, it's not even on their agenda. So you have to look at who you're talking to, how educated they are, what they knew. But I think a lot of people are really oblivious.
That brings me to my question about the David Project, this Center for Jewish Leadership. You describe that as a right-wing group.
Right.
I'd like to know the distinction there. Is it because they're equating the threat of a nuclear Iran with Hitler's final solution? I mean, what are the hallmarks of a right-wing movement that has taken up the cause of Israeli security / U.S. security?
I think there are some interesting things about the David Project and similar groups like that. One is that everything that, quote, threatens Israel is seen as an existential threat. And the other thing is that the Holocaust is evoked very, very quickly to stir up the greatest fear that you can stir up in a population. And so from my point of view, when I see how often the Holocaust is used, it loses its power because every little thing is a future Holocaust. And every issue about land, about power, is an existential threat. So people in those kinds of organizations go directly to the deepest fears that Jews have. And Jews are right to have fears. I mean, horrific things have happened to Jews. Pogroms, there's been the Holocaust. You want history, you can find it. But you also got to look at how do Jews behave in ways that cause people to hate them. And that's very different than anti-Semitism. You know, looking, being critical of Israeli society because it's behaving in a way that defies international law, because there's, for instance, a huge blockade in Gaza and kids are hungry and Israel won't let cement come in across the checkpoint so people can't rebuild their houses after 100,000 people have been made homeless in the last incursion. And this kind of stuff, this is indefensible behavior. But if you frame it the way the David Project frames it, which is that the Jews are the good moral people who are the victims of Palestinian terrorism, and the Palestinians are sort of incomprehensibly fighting the Jews, you'll never get to the core issues. And you just keep fanning the flames. So groups like the David Project define the conversation, they frame the language, they frame the history, and then they go after people who deviate from that. And I think that if you're in favor of democracy, if you're in favor of honesty, if you're in favor of human rights, that that's not a good way to behave, and actually is dangerous because it puts you in a place that's indefensible. And that's where Israel is moving. And that's a great tragedy.
How important is money in all of this? Land, the corporate side of individuals who want Israel to be more powerful and, in fact, bigger in some cases?
First of all, money is critical. The U.S. gives something like $3 billion a year in foreign aid to Israel, which is, I think, the biggest amount they give to any country per person or whatever. And a lot of this money is used to make an occupation possible. There's a huge connection between our military and their military. I had this incredible experience talking with an Israeli soldier who actually was one of the refusers who decided that he could not, in good conscience, serve in the occupied territories. And then he ducked under and went to medical school and was sort of relatively unknown. But he talked about training to be a helicopter pilot. And then he mentioned that he trained in Texas near Dallas. And I was like, floored. And then he said, well, we all train at Bell Helicopter near Dallas. And there's this huge connection between our militaries. And there's a huge amount of money involved, as well as power and military hardware. And the Israeli Defense Force tries out our new weapons. And there's that whole connection, which involves a huge amount of money. And then there are, one of the good things about Jews in general is that they're very philanthropic. So there's a huge support of both the good things in Israel, like Hadassah Hospital, as well as things that I think are much more dubious. So money is a big mover and shaker here. And I think that's why when people talk about, well, how can we make a difference and how can we sort of wake up the world, one of the things that comes to mind is boycotts and divestments and sanctions, because this is a nonviolent way of calling attention to what we feel are unethical ways to behave. And using the power of the purse is one way to have that impact. Unfortunately, I don't own any shares in Caterpillar, so my impact is fairly minimal. But as a concept and as a way to move people, it's a very exciting development that's sort of beginning to seep into the conversation. But money is a major enabler in this conflict.
And of course, during hard economic times in America, we're talking about Caterpillar, one of the companies celebrated by Barack Obama, in fact, but we're also talking about lots of security contracts, lots of technologies. We're talking about a huge amount of military stuff, you know, even drone technology, I believe.
And even like Motorola, you know, we all have Motorola cell phones. They make some of the radar equipment that goes along the separation wall. Well, you could make an argument that you shouldn't be buying Motorola phones because there's a side of this company that's doing something that I find really offensive.
Dr. Alice Rothschild is author of Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. She is co-chair of Jewish Voice for Peace Boston. Her website is alicerothschild.com. This is Dori Smith at Talk Nation Radio Studios in Storrs, Connecticut. Talk Nation Radio airs weekly on community radio stations in the Pacifica broadcast community and on independent stations, internet stations, and podcasting outlets. And you can find them all listed on our website, talknationradio.org. Our music is by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com.